Hi, I'm Lindsay, and I'm talking with medtech industry leaders on how they change lives for a better world.
The inventions and technologies are fascinating, and so are the people who work with them.
There was a period of time where I realized fundamentally my job was to go hang out with really smart people that are saving lives and then do work that would help them save more lives.
I got into the business to save lives, and it is incredibly motivating to work with people who are in that same business, saving or improving lives.
What better industry than where I get to wake up every day and just save people's lives?
These are extraordinary people doing extraordinary work, and this is The Leading Difference.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Leading Difference podcast. I'm your host, Lindsay, and I am so excited to introduce my guest today, Issa Abdul-Karim. Issa is an emerging companies lawyer who helps his clients build their businesses. This can be through raising capital, producing the correct contracts or structures, navigating regulatory hurdles, or purchasing new businesses that will either expand or open a new market for their current businesses. Issa, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love if you wouldn't mind starting off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
So a little bit about myself. I'm an emerging companies lawyer. Some would say a venture capital lawyer as well. I have sort of like a general practice, but my emphasis are in several technology companies, but I have a special interest in medical technology companies, presenting them from their early sort of incubation stages all the way up into hopefully one day some IPO or other form of exit. And a lot of my practice is helping sort of build that out and almost acting as fractional general counsel to a lot of the activities that they do.
And then would you mind telling us a little bit about your background, maybe how you got into this field and specialty in the first place?
Yeah, my journey is quite interesting, actually. It's not a straight line by any means, right? So I actually started after I finished law school, I went and worked for a sports and entertainment law firm where I was representing athletes, entertainers at sort of international tribunals and contract sort of negotiations, mediations. There was contract drafting as well. So it was really cool. It was a lot of fun. And I don't know what possessed me to say, hey, I want to go leave this and go to the exciting world of finance. So I ended up in the finance industry. I worked for a broker-dealer in Montreal. So I did sort of a quasi-legal role there. But at some point, I just missed private practice. So I left, ended up starting my own shop, and then joining up with the firm I'm currently with. And yeah, so as I was developing my practice, I realized that I loved working with startup companies and growth companies, or companies in a growth stage. I found it to be very exciting. And how the medical technology thing sort of happened, it sort of lined up with my interest. And I had one client that sort of reached out to me that was sort of a larger, they had a more established medical technology company than they also had an early stage medical technology company. They had a couple. And it's sort of through that, I really sort of delved into the world of medical technology and all of the legal issues that these companies typically face, both in local markets and international markets. Prior to that, however, I've always been interested in the space. I just didn't know exactly what the space was or meant, right? So yeah, that's a bit of background about me and sort of how I ended up where I am now.
Yeah. And so out of curiosity, did you growing up think, oh my goodness, one day I'm going to be a lawyer? Like, was this always a goal and interest of yours, or has that evolved over time?
Yeah, weird. It's kind of weird how that happened. Law has always been sort of something of interest to me, and from a very young age. And it is something that I've often entertained. I did want to do something a little bit different. Like, it was like, oh, it would be nice to be like a marine biologist. What do they do? It'd be nice to be an astronomer. What do I do? Just look at the stars all day? I'm not 100% sure, right? What that sort of entails. So I was like, okay, I understand what lawyers do, I think, for the most part. So I'll just do that. So yeah,
I love it.
That's kind of how that happened.
Okay. So first was just sort of, okay, I have an idea of what you do. But then, I mean, that's a huge commitment in terms of education and time and all sorts of things. So how has becoming a lawyer and then going from sort of industry to industry, how has that been a compelling thing in your life in terms of career trajectory as you've gone from one industry to another?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I kind of like it personally, just because when I first started, and even a little bit right now, I'm sort of industry agnostic. I wouldn't have been where I am today if not for the journey that I've had. I kind of done everything that I wanted to do. Like prior to law school, I taught. I was a teacher, you know, because it was always like, maybe I should become a teacher. Then I went to law school, wanted to work in sports and entertainment. I think every entry class has about 30% of the students want to enter into that. I was very fortunate that I ended up in there. So, and then I went, I always wanted to try the world of finance. I tried that, got to see what that was about. It was interesting. Not interesting enough for me to stay, but interesting.
Sure.
So it was, it's good. It's been a very good journey in that regard. And I'm just happy that I ended up dealing with medical technology as one of my major verticals. So that's been, it's been really cool. And I've been very fortuitous to have that experience. And it's exciting. I enjoy the pace of it.
Yeah, for sure. So with medical device companies in particular, I imagine that each industry and of course each company has different focus points in terms of legal considerations, but medtech is a very heavily regulated industry. So what are some of the top considerations that you help, especially very young startups, maybe it's their very first invention or product? What are some of the considerations that you always help them to think through from a legal perspective?
That's a loaded question. And I don't want to...
Okay, that's fair.
No, this is a very loaded question. It's a good question, though. I don't want to give you a lawyerly answer and say it depends. But in a way, it does. But I think the essentials are... There's a few. So, you know, contracts are very important, obviously. Having the right contracts in place is a very good starting point, especially with your founders. Everyone sort of starts your relationship thinking, oh, this is sort of like a kumbaya kind of moment. We're all going to be fine. Everything's going to work out. But the reality is, you know, I'm not paid to think about the kumbaya moments. I'm paid to think about, you know, what's the worst that can possibly happen and how do we account for that, unfortunately, right? So that's one thing that's very important. Understanding where everyone's responsibilities are, outlining that in a document is a very, very good starting point. The other critical starting point, I would say, is liability, particularly in the medical technology industry. It's a highly regulated industry. There's a lot of money flowing around. And with that, there's a ton of risk. So as an example, for Canadian companies, they will be receiving any sort of regulatory approvals that you need to receive from the relevant Canadian authorities. And once you obtain that, you have it, you're in the market. But more often than not, you're looking to expand to the United States, as an example. Now, there are a number of considerations when you're having to do that. There's obviously FDA regulations that you have to worry about, certain sort of disclosures that are required to be made. And this isn't even going into like the intellectual property element of patents and other sort of important intellectual property issues. But just focusing right now on the corporate side, and I'll speak from a Canadian perspective and I'll transition into the US, but when a Canadian looks at the US, the biggest thing they're afraid of is getting sued. And understandably so. The United States is the most litigious society on earth in the entire world. I think I saw a statistic where it said there's a lawsuit literally every second. And
oh my word.
Yeah, so it's understandable. There's a high risk, high reward. Because the United States is such a large market and there's so much promise here, people want to enter into it, but they want to be very careful when entering into it. And I typically advise them the relevant corporate structure to enter in to this market for. Now, there's a distinction, right? There's the early stage element where we're dealing with startups, making sure the correct contracts are in place. There is a basic corporate structure in place. And you're working towards some sort of intellectual property ownership because that's critically important, particularly in this field. Although I'm not an intellectual property lawyer, I'm not a patent lawyer. I do some intellectual property work. I'm not a patent lawyer specifically. You know, familiarized with trademarks, copyrights, but patents are a very sort of technical area of law. But it's critically important to have your eye on the prize and want to work towards that. So I do liaise with patent agents, patent attorneys, and other relevant legal minds. So that's all part of the process. I think building your vision very early, understanding how you want to get there and where you want to go is all critical and part of the process. In my experience, patents take a very long time relatively to secure. But I think that's the end goal. And even with that, there's a time limit after you obtain it to file for it in other countries. So it becomes a global thing as well. But yeah, so at the early stage, you want to work primarily on the structuring, get the right team together, make sure everyone has the right documents in place. Could be employment agreements, could be independent contractor agreements. It depends on how you want to structure your company, how much appetite you have for it, what your relationship with the employees or independent contracts ought to be. And even, you know, it's the boring stuff like share classes, understanding how those work. And then there's raising money. And that's a big one because everybody needs money to operate to their company and to get it off the ground. So those are some of the early stage considerations. When you're sort of like at a growth stage, what you're looking at is market entry, how to enter into foreign markets, which obviously I help my clients with as well.
Yeah. So lots of considerations. So we can just barely scratch the surface and folks should hire you if they need additional support.
For sure.
You know, it's so interesting. Thank you for sharing some of those considerations and bringing to light some things you might not think of initially, especially like you mentioned, it does feel very exciting when you start a company and you have all of the like celebratory moments because everything is exciting and a big deal. And then, like you said, but you have to think, it is your job to think about what could go wrong though, and then prepare for that. So I am curious though, that sparked a question for you personally in your own life. How are you able to separate or negotiate the fact that a lot of what you need to do is look for worst case scenario when probably you wouldn't want to do that in your personal life all of the time? So I'm curious how that works where it's like your work is so heavily focused on being proactive in a preventive way. However, at the same time for you personally, how do you balance that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a good question too, because we have, listen, I'll be honest with you. Lawyers are pessimistic by nature, right? I think generally speaking, we just think of the worst case scenario. I'm not like that personally. I'm an optimist. I'm a cautious optimist, a realistic optimist, whatever you want to call it, right? My philosophy is always hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. I think it's critically important to do that. I do that in my personal life. I do it in my professional life. And just because you're thinking of the worst case scenario doesn't mean it's going to happen, right? You just have to calculate for it. My job is to make sure we don't get to that point, right? But you have to account for it nonetheless.
Yeah. So you are able to keep the perspective of we're doing this as something to be prepared for, as a preventative, and not get to that point. So therefore, it can be a little bit more optimistic and a little less.
Yeah. And it's so awesome. Difficult. It's so difficult too, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Just because so much of my job is, you know, thinking about that stuff. Yeah. It's very easy to get down on yourself outside of work. So you need to be really good at sort of detaching. I have a good support system in place. That's very important. I didn't marry a lawyer. I know a lot of people that do, like lawyers marry other lawyers. So I think the fact that I'm not married to one probably helps.
Like, yeah.
I know me. If I was married to one, we just talk shop when I got home. So, and I know a lot of lawyers that are married to other lawyers, and it works for them. I think they probably make it a point to probably detach, and they probably understand each other in that sort of capacity. But I'm married to an accountant. So a very different world. And I think it's beneficial for me.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Awesome. So with the med tech industry specifically, when you do get to work with those clients, what are some of the things that stand out to you as being particularly noteworthy or enjoyable? What in particular do you like about this industry?
Oh, I love how brilliant everyone is. Everyone is so smart, so much smarter than I am. Like it's amazing.
Yeah, it is, I get that.
It's really cool. There are so many smart people in this industry, and watching, not only watching, but also being in that room with people who are trying to solve a problem makes such a massive difference, because I feel it pulls myself up as well. I really have to be on my A game. And because of that, it's just so enjoyable working with them. So yeah, definitely. It's definitely the intelligence. That's one thing. Another sort of element is, and I went to law school with this intention, I always wanted to be able to provide for my family, but I always wanted to do good. I wanted to be able to sleep at night and knowing that I was doing good. And when I'm just servicing medical technology companies, I know, obviously you have to care about the bottom line. That's part of the business side of it. But a lot of the founders, their intentions aren't just the bottom line. Their intentions are, we want to change the world for the better. And we want to make the world a better place. We want to make it easier for everyone who's going through this particular difficulty, and we want to make their life easier. And I think that's remarkable. So one of the greatest pleasures I have is I'm trying to help them achieve that goal, and I'm trying to help them, you know, realize that success. And that is really cool for me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I think those two things are, I agree with both of them. I really enjoy both of those elements. I also really like, I don't know what your experience has been, but one thing that I very much enjoy about the industry is how friendly people tend to be. And they tend to be just very welcoming and right. Tell us about you. Tell us, you know, it's just an inclusive place for the most part. And I hope it will continue down that pathway because
I think the people I've met are very receptive. And I think that's really cool. Because typically, and I'll be honest with you, in some industries, there's almost, I want to call it a fraternity, where they try to keep people out. But I haven't found that in the medical technology industry. I found that people are very receptive, very open. And I think the worldview actually is a little bit different from other industries in that sense. There's a very human side to this that I think everyone appreciates. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, are there any moments along your lawyerly journey where you had this realization, maybe you were helping a client or it could be anything, where you just had this thought of, wow, this is why I do what I do?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's a really basic one I had recently, a couple of months ago. So I drafted up an independent contractor agreement for a client and things didn't work out. Independent contractor got upset. They parted ways, independent contractor comes back threatening to sue. The client goes, hey, look at the contract. You can't do that. And I was like, yeah, I drafted that. So this is what I do. Okay, cool. So there's purpose to my job and the work I do. So that
of
was,
course.
Yeah. So that was a full circle moment. That was really cool.
Yeah, exactly. Seeing it in real time, the protections that you've put in place actually helping your clients, which of course you want them to, but if they're not tested.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the other things I think that was really cool recently was one of my clients launched in another jurisdiction. I helped set that up, and knowing that, and I've seen testimonies of, you know, the product and the treatments that the clients were receiving, and to be a part of that is really something special.
Yes. Yes, absolutely agree. Absolutely. Yeah. And so coming down the line, what are some of your things that you're looking forward to with your firm, with your clients, or, you know, continuing to expand? What are some things to look forward to?
Yeah, it's an exciting time for me just because I'm expanding my practice a little bit in the sense that I'm really digging into sort of the medical technology community, and even to an extent, the health tech community. So it's exciting for me because I'm moving in that direction and I'm really doubling down on helping my clients open up their companies into international markets. So that's been really exciting. We do quite a bit of work in the Middle East, for example, but the United States for a lot of people is a big market. So expansion here is very important. And even for US clients, you know, expanding outwards is still really good for simply diversifying your portfolio. And there's many, many companies that do this. The Canadian market is really good for that as well, because we do have a robust economy. We do have a good set of regulations in place. Market entry is a little bit difficult because of the regulations, but we have a very sophisticated consumer market and a very good infrastructure, which is the appeal of Canada, which is something I didn't realize until earlier this year. In my mind, it was, why come to Canada when you can go to the US, right? And it still very much is the case. If you just look at the consumer market, ours is smaller naturally. The US has, I think, the second largest consumer market in the world behind China. So it makes sense why companies would want to open up in the US over Canada. But for US companies that are already established here, I think it's a very good move for them to establish themselves in Canada, just because there is a very sophisticated user base and consumer base for the products that you would launch there.
Yeah. So continuing to expand even more into helping those clients as they look towards more global reach, essentially, and yeah, continuing to build up that med tech portfolio. Sounds good.
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. Again, just because of the people you meet, super, super exciting. I mean, there's been, There's so many anecdotal stories. There's a saying amongst lawyers, we'll do everything for you. Just give it the book rights, right? Like your story is so phenomenal. Just waive your book rights. So when at the end of my career, I can put it in my book and tell people about it sort of thing, right? Because we do a lot of that. And some of the stories we see are truly sort of remarkable. And a lot of what we do, it's kind of sad, but funny at the same time, because like, one of my mentors says, and one of the principal lawyers at my firm, he says, listen, they're either going to get us on the way in or the way out. You know, one way or another, you're going to need us. Either when you're starting the company, you're going to hire us, or you're going to make a mistake down the line and you're going to need us down the line. And unfortunately, I've seen the latter situation where down the line, things have gotten really, really bad. And have you had just spent, you know, a little money up front, this wouldn't have cost you $1 million later on. And that has happened. Oh. And it has happened. I've seen it happen firsthand. And it's super unfortunate.
Yeah. So in general, I'm not putting words into your mouth, but it sounds like one of the first things if you establish your own company is to consult with a lawyer.
I think so. I think as far as, and obviously I have my bias here, but I've seen companies that started barely anything, right? And they build into this thing that they never thought they'd be. Like this massive, massive company, right? And not to say that they never wanted to reach that point or they never wanted to get to that point, but it grew into something that they never thought, even dreamed possible, right? In a very, very good way. The problem is the foundational documents and the relationships they had with maybe vendors or licensees weren't the best in nature. And then I have to come in and I'm doing crisis management at this point. I'm either managing their litigation or... if I'm not managing their litigation, I'm trying to diffuse the situation so it doesn't get worse. Could be through mediations and out of court discussions, right? Even though I'm not a litigator, I do this sort of litigation management. All that to say, and long-winded way of answering your question is, yes, please consult a lawyer as early as you possibly can, as early as you can afford it. You want to be able to resolve issues before they get to court, generally, right? When you're not the offensive side, but even when you are suing, right? Because obviously, if you have a patent interest in something where someone's infringing on your patents or, you know, maybe there's a commercial disagreement, even if you are the party suing, you have to be very careful when going to court. And the reason for that is you cannot tell who the judge is going to be and how they're going to view things. It's always, you always throw the ball up in the air. You know, even we as lawyers, we can do as much case law research as we want. We can look at the legislation as hard as we want. We can really scrutinize it. We can go into the wording. We can make our arguments. But we cannot guarantee that things will, you know, end up in your favor. And even if you have a really strong case, because when you go into court, anything can happen. From witnesses to the judge's opinion, maybe their own personal experience in something, you don't know. So even in that situation, it often is better to settle outside of court or have some sort of discussion. But yeah, it's an important sort of strategy to note. That dispute resolution is a critical part of any legitimate litigation strategy, in my view, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I absolutely see the value, of course, in that. And then, and like you said, you end up sort of inviting in non-controllable human elements into the mix.
Absolutely.
If you do end up. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, but because,
all right.
It's not, I think if a lawyer tells you this is a slam dunk, you should be very cautious. I think that's a big, maybe it's a red flag. It's definitely like an orange flag, not even a yellow,
okay,
orange flag, right? So you definitely want to watch out for that. Because if a lawyer's telling you, oh, this is a slam dunk, this is not a problem, are you a psychic? Do you know the judge person? Like, you know what? There's a lot of things that can go wrong. And by the way, it's all very expensive to go to court. It is
right.
Very expensive. And this bothers me because even lawyers are expensive, right? I know this.
Right.
It's unfortunate because access to justice is something very important to me. But the problem is there's a big paywall behind it. So, and it's one of the things a lot of early stage companies struggle with. So how can you get legitimate and valid legal advice when you can't afford it? So there's actually two ways I have in my mind, and I guess I'll share it with you right now. And perhaps your listeners will find value in it. One of them is obviously to join some sort of incubator or accelerator. Those are always good. Just because of the network you can build in them. So one of the other thing is, and perhaps if you'd like, we can talk about investing right after this.
Yeah.
You'd be able to connect with, you know, could be venture capitalists, could be angels. But what's important, you open up sort of a new network for yourself in a myriad of different ways. So that's the first element. The second element, and I posted on this on LinkedIn a couple months ago, it's you can have an advisor committee where you give maybe 1% or 2% of your equity or whatever the advisor wants, but you can bring a lawyer onto that advisor committee for equity. That way you're not actually paying liquidable cash for that advice, but you're actually bringing them in to advise you on how to set things up while giving some maybe 1% or 2% of your company away, which may be a lot, maybe a little, depending on how valuable the lawyer is, but it's a good way to save upfront cost.
Those are great suggestions. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's great advice. And then you mentioned the investing side. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So financing is a difficult thing, right? Because you're very sort of subservient to the markets.
Sure.
In that sense, right? And we're in a little bit of a down market right now, but people are still raising capital. I know people that completed about a $50 $60 million raise like about 4 or 5 months ago. So, I mean, money is still being moved. But the sort of important thing here is, and I can't emphasize this enough, there is an important distinction between smart money and dumb money. And what I mean by that is, it sounds crazy, but anyone can go out and get money. You can go and you get in front of the right person and they'll just give you, they'll write a check for $300,000, $400,000, whatever, right? The problem is, you don't want to just take cash. I mean, you can, but it's not going to open up a network if that person doesn't have the network that you need. The smarter way to go about it is to make sure to get it, bring in an investor that can actually open up a network for you. Because at some point they might want a board seat. And those shouldn't be given away just to anyone. It has to be very strategic. And one of the important things I find is that if you have a very good investor, someone who actually has a market behind them, and since we're talking about the medical technology space, we want someone that invests into medical technology companies, that understands the vertical. Because when they come in, they likely already have an ecosystem that you can use. I don't want to say have a relationship with the regulators, but they might be familiar with the regulators and maybe familiar with certain professionals that they can introduce you to. They may have in their own portfolio connections to distributors. That could be huge. That could be more valuable than the $1 million they just gave you, because it might open up a $10 million market for you just by virtue of the fact that you got introduced to a distributor because of this person's reputation. So you have to scrutinize your investors as much as they scrutinize you. And I know that's difficult sometimes because obviously there's a huge power dynamic between early stage companies, even growth companies, growth stage companies, and an investor when you're literally might be on fumes and your runway is at its very end, maybe like a month or two away from giving out. So it's very difficult to sort of stand there and tell them like, look, you need to open this, this, and this door for me, you to bring me in. Very difficult to put yourself in that position, but that's the position you ideally want to be in. Connect with someone who can open up a market for you. And I think that's one of the most important things about bringing investors in.
Yes, thank you. That's really great advice. And that's the first time I've heard that particular advice. So I really appreciate you sharing that.
You're welcome.
I think that brings a lot of value to when people are looking for those resources. And like you said, maybe the $1 million, I mean, it is cash. It's going to be useful, but it might not be, as you said, in the long term as impactful to your business as those relationships and those contacts can be. So something to really think about
and
take seriously.
It can be very difficult sometimes to remove those investors that have invested into the company that you don't want anymore. And they're just taking up a spot in your cap table while not really bringing anything. And that's very difficult. And this is one of those other issues is if you don't have something in writing that allows for you to both parties to sort of step away amicably, they'll be stuck on there.
Yeah.
And that's happened. And I've had sort of like these business divorces that I deal with, which is not fun, but it is sort of part of the game as well. But there are strategies you can employ at a high level without breaking any laws that will help remedy that. But again, that's situation by situation.
Absolutely. So you have shared lots of great advice, but I would just say when I summarize it in my mind, one of the biggest things is talk to a lawyer early and often. There you go. Amazing. Right.
You play the log game, you know, make a friend, be like, hey, listen, you'd make a great lawyer one day and just kind of push them to law
school. Brilliant.
Push them into law school.
maybe offer to contribute to the law school tuition, yeah, just a little, you know.
I just believe in you so much.
That's amazing. I love it. Well, pivoting a little bit just for fun, imagine you were to be offered $1 million to teach a masterclass on anything you want. It could be in your field, but it doesn't have to be at all. Mm-hmm. What would you choose to teach and why?
I think I'd want to teach people how to motivate themselves. I have a background in coaching, in sports. So I've always found it, and no matter what sort of industry I've been in, what position I've been in, I find great value in being able to motivate others. I think it's very important. And I find great satisfaction in it. And it's really, it feels really good when you see people becoming successful, perhaps not, I don't want to say as a result of it, your advice, but partly as a result of your advice or your encouragement. So I would probably put together some sort of masterclass on how to get out of bed in the morning, how to set your goals, how to set your visions, and how to execute on those visions.
Yeah, that's a great masterclass and one that I'm sure a lot of people would sign up for because it's so important. I recently actually listened to just a snippet. I need to go back and listen to the whole thing, but of a TED Talk where the woman was talking about how we often treat confidence as a nice to have instead of a must have, right, and what a difference it makes when you do treat it as a must have. And anyway, that I thought of that immediately when you were talking about the motivation, yeah, but sometimes you need a coach to kind of come alongside you and help with that and say, yeah, no, yeah, you can do this. Let's figure out how we're going to do this together.
Yeah. Lindsay, it takes, honestly, it can just be one person, just mm-hmm, one person that says, I believe you can do this. It makes an entire a huge difference. And I don't think some people maybe do realize this. Others don't realize how big that can be.
Mm. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And I just kept thinking that that was a very good point and a serious one. But the first thought that popped into my mind was like, okay, who do I know that I could tell, you know, yes, I think you'd make an excellent lawyer.
You're always giving, Lindsay. It's really good. I like the way you're
so giving.
Helping propel everyone forward. It's really good.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah. So how do you wish to be remembered after you leave this world?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I deal with some incredible entrepreneurs that at this point in their careers, they're not even thinking about, you know, exits or companies. They're thinking about legacy. And, yeah, you know, they want to be sort of remembered as luminaries and experts, not just experts in the field, but people who sort of changed the world. So for myself, I do eventually want to get to the point where I can change the world. I don't know what that's going to look like or how it's going to happen, but I want some sort of positive lasting influence in the world that I played a part in doing. Now, interestingly mentioned, like, how do I want to be remembered? I don't necessarily have to be remembered for doing it, but I want to know to myself that I was a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then final question, what is something that makes you smile every time you see or think about it?
My life. Just
yes.
You know, retrospect really is 2020. And yeah, it's this crazy, life is just crazy thing, right? You know, we go through so many difficulties, and everybody does, that you just can't see it, right? We all go through these difficulties, these ups and downs, these mountains and valleys, these peaks and valleys. And no, not everybody sort of broadcasts what they go through, right? A lot of times you only share the good things. Particularly with social media today. And that can have a negative effect on a lot of people's mental health. But I look back on my life and I think if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have ended up there. And I really was happy doing that over there. But if that did happen, I wouldn't have ended up there. And I probably would have been miserable over there in that sort of situation. And I realized, and I look, and there's this forming, this beautiful tapestry. And I realize how beautiful it all is. And I smile because, you know, I like to sort of sit and think. Like, I can sit in front of an ocean or something or some sort of skyline view and just sit and just think about this sort of stuff in retrospect, about all of this sort of stuff and how all these sort of things happen. And in the moment, you can't see it. You're blind because we can't see forward. We can only imagine forward, right? But, you know, when you look back on everything, everything happens for a reason. I truly do believe that, good and bad. And a better day will come. And I smile because you can't see it then. I probably can't see it now in whatever situation I'm in now, right? But, you know, there might be a day where I'm going to look back, laugh at it, smile at it, like I often do. So yeah, my life is probably one of the things that I smile at one of the most, just looking back in retrospect.
Yeah, I love that answer. And I'm so glad to hear it. I love that enthusiasm for life and that perspective of there's a reason for things. And if this didn't happen, then I wouldn't be where I am today.
Yeah.
I think that helps. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, and I think that introspect is critically important. Because you have to try to make sense of things, right? And the problem is, in my view, right, we're so caught up in the grind that we don't take that moment to just sort of reflect. And I think if you do, there you achieve some sort of clarity. Everything seems clouded right now. And entrepreneurs will tell you they're doing a million things at once. And I'm not even exaggerating. They probably have 100 things on their to-do list. And you get so bogged down in it, you can't look up. But one of the best solutions to that is to step back and think about how things have played out in your life thus far and where you are today and how that happens. And even if you're not where you want to be today, tomorrow is still there. So I think taking that moment for introspection not only helps you sort of process everything that happened in the past, but you know also helps you move forward into a better future.
Yes, absolutely. Could not agree more. Great perspective. And it keeps you sane too, because there's so much out of our control that if we can control our attitude and our perception and the way that we choose to process and reflect, then we can still choose to see the good, even when it might be a little bit tricky because it doesn't feel good in the moment.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And there's an interesting sort of, I don't know if I want to call it a theory, but scarcity mindset versus an abundance mindset. And I, for a long time, was part of the scarcity mindset model. And for those who may or may not know, scarcity is where you think there's just, oh, there's never enough business out there for me. I'm never going to be able to make, you know, enough money or make the right connections or people. And when someone else does it, you're like, oh no, how could they have done it? Now I can't get it anymore, sort of thing. But that sort of thought process is very defeatist, self-defeating, actually. Whereas if you come from the thought process of an abundance mindset, where like, oh, okay, they did that. That's great for them. I can do it too. There's more than enough people. There's more than enough business and more than enough opportunities for me to execute on and sort of take advantage of. And we're all going to make it one day. So.
Yes. Yep. I fully agree with that and could talk about that forever. So I'll have to restrain myself this time. But I fully agree with you. This has been a fantastic conversation. I so appreciate you sharing your advice, your background, some things to consider, and just your very positive outlook on life. I think that's incredible. So we are really honored to be making a donation on your behalf as a thank you for your time today.
No, thank you.
To Sleep in Heavenly Peace, which provides beds for children who don't have any in the United States. So thank you very much for supporting that particular organization. And I just wish you the best continued success with your abundance mindset and your zest for life as you work to change lives for a better world.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And you're a wonderful host. And I love what you're doing with the podcast. And I hope for your success in the future. Or continued
success. Well, thank you. Thank you. I very much appreciate that. And thanks also to our listeners for tuning in. And if you're feeling as inspired as I am right now, I'd love if you'd share this episode with a colleague or two. And we'll catch you next time.
The Leading Difference is brought to you by Valentium. Valentium is a full-service CDMO with 100% in-house capability to design, develop, and manufacture medical devices from Class 2 wearables to Class 3 active implantable medical devices. Valentium specializes in active implantables, leads, programmers, and accessories across a wide range of indications, such as neuromodulation, deep brain stimulation, cardiac management, and diabetes management. Valentium's core competencies include electrical, firmware, and mechanical design, mobile apps, embedded cybersecurity, human factors and usability, automated test systems, systems engineering, and contract manufacturing. Valentium works with clients worldwide, from startups seeking funding to established Fortune 100 companies. Visit Valentium.com to explore your next step in medical device development.